This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I am Dilan Okçuoğlu. I'm a Mustafa Barzani Postdoctoral Fellow and Professorial Lecturer in Global Kurdish Studies, American University School of International Service in Washington, D.C. And this is our third episode for Kurdish Studies series of New Books Network. And we have Yanni Voller, who is a professor at University of Kent School of Politics and International Relations. Today, we are going to talk about Yaniv's second book on second-generation liberation movements, rethinking colonialism in Iraqi Kurdistan and southern Sudan, which is published from Cambridge University Press in this year. Welcome, Yaniv.
Hi, Dilan. Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. We are very happy to host you today for our third episode in Kurdish Studies. So let's start with you, because I would like you to introduce yourself to our listeners. I'm pretty sure most of them know you from your work, but can you please introduce yourself briefly?
Yeah, absolutely. So as you mentioned, I'm at the School of Politics and IR at the University of Kent. I'm a senior lecturer in Middle East Studies. Before that, I was a Leverhulme Fellow at the University of Edinburgh. I got my PhD from the London School of Economics. And I've been working on Kurdistan for a very long time now. But as you can see from the book, I've also been spreading to other cases in other regions.
Yeah, exactly. So I was about to ask you that question, specific question about your second book, which is actually today's topic. It will be actually under the spotlight. But can you please give us a little background on this book? Because it's also quite connected to your first book. I will be really happy to hear you to summarize the gist of the book for ourselves, for the listeners, actually.
Yes, of course. Excellent. So this book is about, it's about liberation wars, but it is about post-colonial liberation wars. So in other words, this book focuses on the liberation movements that emerged in post-colonial states and the wars between liberation movements that represent minorities in the peripheries of the newly founded states and the governments, which themselves had risen from the struggle against European colonialism. Now, the reason that the book is titled Second Generation Liberation Wars is that In this book, I argue that these new liberation wars, or these post-colonial liberation wars, in fact, recreated many of the conditions and factors that shaped the first generation liberation wars, right? So the wars between the colonized people in Asia, Africa, and the Middle East, and European imperialism. And understanding these wars requires a better understanding of role perceptions, identities, and practice in international politics. So in order to illustrate my argument, in order to discuss these second generation liberation wars, I use the cases of the liberation wars in Iraq and Sudan between the Kurdish and the Southern Sudanese nationalist or separatist movements against the governments in Baghdad and Khartoum. So and while I'm using these cases, I also, I hope, provide a detailed narrative of these liberation wars and these liberation movements.
Okay, thank you so much for this detailed answer. I think it's now very clear to our listeners. And it directly links us to the next question, which is about the motivations behind writing such an interesting book. Like, Yaniv, how did you decide to work on this topic for your second book?
Thanks for the question. So I think this book is very much a continuation of my previous research and my previous book, and my overall interest in the, I think what I can describe as the politics of the margins, right? Of my interest in movements and actors that have operated in the periphery, especially liberation movements that represent persecuted minorities. And I think the story of how I've come about to carry out this research also shows, it really shows nicely the process that I think we often go through when we develop our subjects of interest. So my previous book, if I may go back for just a minute to my previous book, my previous book was about the emergence and the development of the Kurdish de facto state in northern Iraq or in Iraqi Kurdistan. And in this book, in this previous book, I was trying to show how this position or status of de facto unrecognized statehood shaped the strategies and the perceptions and the behavior of the Kurdish leadership in Iraq. But so it very much focused on the period following 1991 and especially 2003. But when I was writing the book, I thought that, you know, it is necessary to provide a very brief background on the pre-autonomy period, on the period that kind of led to the emergence of the Kurdistan regional government and the Kurdish de facto state. So I wanted to do it thoroughly. So I went to the archives. I went to the archives at SOAS and Exeter and Durham University and the Kurdish Institute of Paris. And I started reading a bit pamphlets and newspapers and journals that were published by the Kurdish parties, by the Kurdistan Democratic Party, and later by the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan. And these archives have really impressive collections, and I was really enjoying reading the kind of discourse and narrative that the Kurdish nationalist movement was building in the 1950s, 60s, 70s. And in one case, I was reading the Kurdistan Democratic Party's, you know, party organ from 1972. It was in Arabic, so it was designated for Arabic speaking, Arabic reading audiences. And in this journal, there was one entry about the peace agreement between the Sudanese government and the Southern Sudanese rebels, right? The Southern Sudanese Liberation Movement. And so, you know, and the article kind of discussed how how this peace agreement is really important for other liberation movements and other oppressed minorities. And it really stressed the importance of the Southern, you know, Sudanese liberation movement. And to me, it was quite a revelation that there was actually, you know, we tend to talk about the national liberation movement, on the anti-colonial movement, when we talk about the movements that fought against European imperialism. But, and you know, in retrospect, it may sound a bit intuitive or obvious, but to me, it was quite surprising to think that there was actually a global movement of post-colonial anti-liberation movements. And this really triggered my interest, right? And I started thinking a lot about how important this episode actually was in shaping statehood and the idea of independence, and really thinking about how these movements, you know, the post-colonial liberation movements, perceived themselves and their ideas and what they were trying to achieve. So I finished my PhD dissertation that served as the basis for my previous book, and I knew that this is going to be my next project. I'm going to focus on Sudan and Iraq, or more precisely, on the Kurdish movement in Iraq and the Southern Sudanese movement. So I started delving more into the case of the Southern Sudanese liberation movement, and I started comparing it to the Kurdish liberation struggle in Iraq. But at this point, I started realizing another thing. I started realizing that liberation struggles are not just about the liberators, right? They're not just about the liberation movement, but it's also about the other side, the government. So, you know, the oppressors, depends, of course, on which perspective you're taking. And I've become, so at this point, it became clear to me that this is what I'm interested in, right? The nature and the sources and the factors that shaped the post-colonial liberation wars. And this is where I started developing my idea of first generation and second generation liberation movements and liberation wars.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So quite interesting also because, like we know, liberation strategies can take different forms. And you delve into this extensive topic in both of your book projects, like in the first and second book, you cover different aspects of those liberation strategies that have been used by guerrilla fighters and also different liberation movements. So you briefly touched on that, but I would like you to elaborate a little further on that. How do you think your second book project is linked to your first book project, that you published?
It is very much connected, I think, because in a way, you can say that my second book, right, this current book, it actually closes the circle with my first book. Because in the first book, the liberation struggle of the 1950s, 1970s, you know, even the 1980s, it was mainly in the background. I focused much more on the post-1990s, on the nature of liberation struggle in the post 1990s, right? And I demonstrated, I paid a lot of attention to the idea of state building as a liberation strategy, right? As to state building as an act of liberation in itself that kind of replaced the more classic liberation strategies such as guerrilla warfare and, you know, liberation diplomacy. And in my new book, I actually go back. And I devote much more attention to these classic liberation strategies, right? To the emergence of guerrilla, of guerrilla fighting, of guerrilla strategies. And I end the book in the early 1990s, where state building was gradually becoming a strategy. So you know, so as I said, it's I'm I'm closing the circle with the second book.
Okay, yes, it's now much clearer to me. And again, amazing work. And I would encourage everyone to read it and sign it for their courses on like rebel diplomacy, rebel politics, but also state building, state-society relations, and of course, comparative MENA politics. So the next question is actually, again, you have mentioned most of it, but I'm pretty sure there are a lot to say about the main takeaways and main contributions of your work, mostly because it's a good example of interdisciplinary approach to social science. And sometimes, you know, we know that this is an aspect that is that can be ignored, especially in international politics. So what are the main contributions of your book, and what should your readers, students and scholars in international politics learn from your book, Yaniv?
So I would say that this book has several themes, and I really try to address as many audiences as possible. It is an interdisciplinary book in nature, because my work, my research is interdisciplinary in nature. I really do believe in the in bridging between politics and IR and sociology and history, and I really did try to achieve that in the book. So, for example, I would say from a history perspective, right? From the perspective of historiography, this book seeks to challenge how we perceive colonialism and decolonization, because the literature tends to the literature on colonialism and decolonization often tends to view these themes, right? To view colonialism and decolonization as particular moments in history, right? Colonialism is usually when researchers use the term colonialism, they usually refer to, you know, to the episode in which European imperial powers occupied overseas territories and started exploiting their lands and their natural resources and their people. Whereas decolonization is the episode in which European powers began withdrawing from these territories, right? With the British handing over Hong Kong back to China as the end of the episode of decolonization. And what I'm trying to show in this book is that for many movements, for many communities within the newly formed states, within the post-colonial states, colonialism actually didn't end. Now, I'm actually not referring to the idea of neo-colonialism and you know, the more Marxist perception of neo-colonialism and exploitation by economic powers. What I'm referring to is that, what I'm trying to say is that for many communities in the newly independent state, colonialism didn't really end. Colonialism in its most basic definition, right? Meaning the occupation and exploitation of people and land. It didn't end, but it simply now gained a new face, right? Many of the post-colonial liberation movements didn't speak of neo-colonialism. They started seeing themselves as the victims of classic colonialism, right? The same colonialism that was initially designed and used by colonial powers, but was now taking place in the new countries, right? And it was practiced by the new governments. And I demonstrate, for example, in the book, I demonstrate how the Southern Sudanese rebels and how the Kurdish, you know, nationalists, as you can see in the book, the Southern Sudanese liberation activists and the Kurdish nationalists, right? The Anyanya or the other Southern Sudanese liberation movements and the KDP in Kurdistan, they actually spoke in terms of Arab or Iraqi or Sudanese colonialism, right? They actually talked about the Arab exploitation of the native black African in Southern Sudan, of the native Kurds. And really, this movement, the intellectual leaders of these movements, they actually embraced a very nativist discourse. They portrayed themselves as the native populations that are being exploited by the other, by an external occupier that tries to impose on them its language, its culture, and even religion in the case of Sudan, right? On the path of stealing their natural resources. Now, the thing is, and I think this is the more controversial part of the book, but I really strive to support this argument, they were not entirely wrong. They're actually quite right in depicting the situation in this way, because the Iraqi and the Sudanese governments really did apply what you can describe as textbook colonial strategies and tactics and practices to oppress the Kurds and the South Sudanese and then their liberation aspirations and actually exploiting their territories and their people and their natural resources, right? So you have the changing Iraqi and Sudanese governments employing the same divide and rule strategies that exploited tribal, religious, and social cleavages to divide the Kurds and the Southern Sudanese, right? To try and steer confrontations between, you know, among the Kurds and the Southern Sudanese. You have these governments, you can actually see these governments recruiting tribal militias and guards from the local population to serve as the local police, just as the British did in Sudan and Iraq. You actually have the governments in Baghdad and Khartoum sending settlers, right, from perceived loyalist populations, namely Arab settlers, to Iraqi Kurdistan and to southern Sudan in order to take control over these territories, in order to change their demography. And even the discourse, right, even the Iraqi and Sudanese discourse was inspired by the colonial discourse, right? They started talking about the civilizing mission, the Arab or even Islamic civilizing mission. So the government in Khartoum, which tried to forcibly Islamize and Arabize the southern Sudanese, you actually had Sudanese officials constantly talking about bringing culture and civilization to the primitive Africans, right? They actually talked about dressing the naked Africans, which was the same discourse that the British colonialists were using. And even in the case of Iraq, right, you had different governments, starting from the monarchy to the Ba'ath regime, they were constantly portraying their actions as bringing progress to the underdeveloped region of Kurdistan and to the backward, you know, to the backward Kurdish people. But in reality, of course, Kurdistan and southern Sudan remained very much underdeveloped and marginalized by the center, just as it was in colonial times. But these governments still kept talking about, you know, about the idea of their presence as civilizing the people of the periphery. So this is the book's history perspective. And it's my effort to engage with the historiography of colonialism, decolonization, and liberation. But I think that one question still remains. You know, why did this happen? Why did both the liberation movements and the oppressive governments ended up embracing the same tactics and strategies and ideas of their predecessors? And were they simply imitating their predecessors? Were the Southern Sudanese and Kurdish nationalists portraying themselves as, you know, anti-colonial movements simply because they were trying to imitate the previous successful liberation movements? And the answer is no, right? The answer is much deeper than that. And understanding the causes for why the Kurds and the Southern Sudanese, and I keep referring to the Southern Sudanese rather than South Sudanese, because at the time, and I also stress this in the book, at the time this was still Southern Sudan, right? It wasn't yet South Sudan, the independent state. It was still Southern Sudan, and I think, you know, really understanding the history of the Southern Sudanese and Kurdish liberation movements requires also applying tools from the discipline of, you know, political science and international relations. And I think this really makes this book interdisciplinary in nature. And I'm happy to elaborate on this if you wish.
Definitely. This is actually going to be my next question, because I was very curious about that, since I also pursue interdisciplinary approach to my work on Kurdish borderlands and state control. So what do you exactly mean by interdisciplinary perspective? Because, as I said, this is one of the aspects that make your work quite appealing to your readers. And do you think that there is such a significant gap in the international relations about that?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So I think here comes into the picture the international relations aspect of the book. And what I do in the book is I actually incorporate theories of roles and practice in international politics, right, in international relations, in order to understand these second generation liberation wars, as I'm referring to them. Now, I'm simplifying a bit because we are short, you know, because we are limited in time. But role theory in international relations suggests that actors absorb certain expectations and perceptions about how different actors, how they should behave according to the roles that they wish to play, right? So, for example, when a separatist movement perceives itself as a liberation movement fighting against an external oppressor, its leadership will act on, its leadership will embrace ideas and implement ideas of that they believe that, you know, national liberation movements should adopt, right? They'll behave in the same way that they believe that they've come to learn that liberation movements should behave. Linked to that, I mentioned role theory, but also apply practice theory to understanding these liberation movements. And practice theory is very much linked with role theory, in that it advances the idea that again, actors in international politics adopt certain practices that are related to the roles that they are trying, that they are playing, right? So, for example, when it comes to the Southern Sudanese and Kurdish liberation movements, these movements didn't necessarily initially see themselves as liberation movements, right, or as anti-colonial movements. They were feeling marginalized. They were trying to carve themselves a place in the newly independent state, right? And in many cases, at least in the first years, many Kurds in Iraq, many Southern Sudan, many people in Southern Sudan actually accepted the idea of being part of Iraq or Sudan, right? You actually had, in 1920, you actually had many Kurds joining Arabs in what is now known as the Iraqi revolt of 1920 against British occupation. But once they started feeling marginalized, once they realized that their culture is oppressed and they are being persecuted, they started intellectuals and political leaders of these communities, they started trying to look for ways to express their antagonism toward the new state. And the first thing that the default choice was actually the anti-colonial liberation movement, right? They, because Iraqi Kurds and Southern Sudanese intellectuals, many of them were very much exposed to the events of the first generation anti-colonial struggle against European imperialism. They witnessed it firsthand. They were part of it, as I mentioned, right? Kurds were actually part of the anti-British movement that existed in Iraq in the 1920s, 30s, 40s. They saw how how the different nations in Africa and Asia and the Middle East liberated themselves from European imperialism and colonialism. So for them, it made sense. It made sense that if a movement wants to, if a community, right, if a group of people wants to liberate themselves, if they want to get autonomy or even independence, the only way to achieve it is to become an anti-colonial liberation movement, right? So you actually had the Southern Sudanese and Iraqi Kurds embracing these ideas, adopting them, not because they were necessarily imitating the other liberation movements, not because they were imitating the Arabs in Iraq or Sudan or Egypt or other countries, but because these practices, right, were embedded in the international community or international society, if you want to use a more international relations discourse, right, at the time, and they were exposed to it by either taking an active part in previous years in the anti-colonial liberation struggle against European colonizers, or by constantly engaging with other liberation movements. And I really try to show it in the book. So in the case of the Southern Sudanese, for example, many of the leaders of the Southern Sudanese liberation movement, they traveled across Africa. They attended the newly established universities in Africa. They met there with the leaders of the liberation movements that fought against European colonialism. They discussed with them Che Guevara and Mao Zedong, right? They read a lot of what Gamal Abdel Nasser, right, from Egypt, was writing, and they also met with him. And you actually had, there are so many documentations of Kurdish leaders and Southern Sudanese leaders meeting with Nasser and trying to discuss with him the Kurdish and Southern Sudanese rights for autonomy and even independence. And by the way, Nasser was the greatest disappointment of both the Kurds and the Southern Sudanese because they had so many expectations of him. And the same goes as for the colonial government, by the way. It's not as if... what I'm trying to show in the book is that the post-colonial government, they also ended up resorting, as I mentioned, they also ended up resorting to the colonial practices. But they didn't do so because they wanted to be colonial governments, right? These governments, so the governments in Sudan, the governments in Iraq, they emerged out of the anti-colonial struggle. They, in their vision, they were actually fighting to eliminate colonial legacies in their countries. But when they were facing the same challenges, that the colonial governments were facing, namely dissent in the periphery, their default choice was to resort to colonial practices. They didn't see themselves as doing that, but many of the post-colonial elites were actually very much exposed to colonial practices of oppression. They were exposed to it either as the victims of the colonial oppression, but they were also exposed to it as part of their, some of them were actually part of the colonial establishment. They served as policemen. They were educated in colonial institutions. They were trained by, so for example, military officers in Sudan and Iraq, the first generations were educated by British colonial officers, right? Many of the political elites in Sudan were educated at Gordon Memorial College, right, where they actually had British instructors. So when they resorted to colonial practices, it wasn't necessarily a conscious choice of becoming colonizers, but because these practices were so embedded in their history and their experience that it was almost their default choice to resort to these strategies. And this is what I mean when I say that, you know, we need to think about roles and role perceptions and practices when we think about this episode in you know, in the history of these countries and these movements.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yes, exactly. And that's why you also underline that a couple times actually in different parts of the book. And that's why you also invite your readers to think about a new understanding, like a new conception of international politics. I think that's quite important to remember. You again, like briefly touched on that, but I find it very important. And I think that's one of the main takeaways, of course, at least for me from this book, is the comparison between these different liberation movements, but actually both across time and location, like space. So you make comparison between first generation versus second generation of these liberation movements or anti-colonial movements, but also you make comparison between Iraqi Kurdistan and southern Sudan, both in the past and in modern times, as I said. So can you please tell us a little more about that? Like, what are the similarities and differences between these two liberation movements?
So it was, that's an excellent question, because it was really surprising to learn how similar the Southern Sudanese and Kurdish liberation movements are, and how similar the situation in both countries actually was, right? Because again, we have two post-colonial countries which are dominated by a very particular ethno-religious group, two very large countries, right? And you actually have these Arab Muslim elites dominating a periphery that was much more diverse and much more, heterogeneous. So of course I mentioned that both the Iraqi and Sudanese elites and the governments changed, right? In both countries, particularly in Sudan, you had many changes in the government. In Iraq, less so, because since 1968 and up until 2003, you actually had the Ba'ath government in power. But the point is that you actually had a situation in which an ethnic, in the case of Sudan, of course, ethno-religious minority was fighting for liberation and was fighting against the oppression and imposition of the culture of the ruling elite in the center. Now, when it comes to the Southern Sudanese and the Kurds in Iraq, you can say that both of these communities were subjected to very similar forms of oppression, right? The government in Baghdad employed a brutal physical and cultural Arabization campaign, whereas in the case of Sudan, the Sudanese governments, most of them, try to forcibly Islamize and Arabize the Southerners. Now, you can say that the Southern Sudanese never faced a systemic genocide, as was actually the case of the Kurds in Iraq, right? I mean, in Iraq, you actually had the Ba'ath regime designing and executing a genocidal plan, right? During the Anfal campaign. In Sudan, you never had the same systemic genocide. Of course, you had hundreds of thousands of Sudanese dying in war and starvation, but you never had, you know, you never had this really clearly planned and executed genocide. But the thing is, in both cases, there was an excessive, extreme use of violence and oppression of a community in the periphery that was not feeling part of the country anymore, or that was gradually losing its sense of belonging to the country that they were being part of. They were not being part of the country that was created by the colonial powers. And by the way, the Sudanese and Iraqi governments also realized the similarities between their predicaments in the south and the north, respectively. There is an incident which I mention in the book where the commander of the Sudanese secret police, Sudanese secret police that really dominated the campaign against the counterinsurgency campaign against the Southern Sudanese Liberation Movement. So we actually had this Sudanese police commander visiting Iraq sometimes after the rise of the Ba'ath regime, before the Addis Ababa peace accords. And during this visit, the Sudanese police commander is taken by his hosts in Iraq to northern Iraq to witness how the Iraqi government deals with the Kurdish insurgency, and actually writes back to Khartoum, right? And he tells them how Iraq and Sudan are facing the same problem of separatism, and he was being taken to see how the Iraqi government deals with the situation. And he ended up returning to Sudan with a gift, right? With a police helicopter that was given to the Sudanese police by the Iraqi government. The similarities are quite amazing. Of course, there are many differences, but I have to admit that in this book, because I try to demonstrate the validity of role theory and practice theory to explaining post-colonial violence, I focus much more on the similarities. I guess that you can say that the main difference between Sudan and Iraq, or between the Southern Sudanese and the Kurdish Liberation Movement, is that the Southern Sudanese eventually gained independence, whereas the Kurds in all parts of Kurdistan are still not a state, right? There's no Kurdish state. But even here, there is actually some similarity. And I think it might relate to the next subject you want to discuss.
That's correct, exactly. Because towards the end of your book, in chapter 5, you tell us how guerrilla fighting turns into like state building and rebel diplomacy somehow. Maybe it was not legitimate in the past, but these actors developed strategies so that they would become legitimate actors in international politics. So meanwhile, we also witnessed the change in the meaning of liberation and independence across time. What we see is that this process is still ongoing. So, and it has its own stages. So, what are the difficulties and prospects of this ongoing process for these liberation movements in Iraqi Kurdistan and southern Sudan?
Mm. Mm. Excellent. So as I mentioned, right, and this kind of takes me to the last. It's also related to the last chapter of the book. And as I said, it kind of closes the circle with my previous book in that I try to show how in the late 1980s, and particularly the early 1990s, the perception of what liberation means actually started changing. And you can see both the Kurdish leadership and the Southern Sudanese leadership gradually shifting from focusing on guerrilla fighting and insurgency to state building as kind of, you know, as the main basis for the liberation struggle. And of course, you know, it's important to remember that this also had to do with the opportunities that the Kurds and the Southern Sudanese gained in the 1990s, right? In the case of Kurdistan, the Kurds actually gained autonomy because of external circumstances, because of the collapse of the Ba'ath regime, rather than sudden international legitimacy or acceptance of the demand for independence. And it's quite similar in the case of Southern Sudan, the kind of almost collapse of the central government in the mid 1980s, and then the rise of the Islamist government under Omar al-Bashir. And so the collapse of the central governments in both cases, or the weakening of this, at least in the case of Sudan, the weakening of the central government kind of allowed, they allowed these movements an opportunity to also start focusing on institution building, right? On governance building as the way to continue the liberation struggles. But it wasn't just the opportunities, right? And this is what I try to show in the book. It was also a realization that liberation is changing, that legitimacy is changing, right? It's not enough anymore to be an anti-colonial liberation movement in order to secure at least some legitimacy, if not recognition for these movements' claims for independence, and at least some legitimacy to continue making these demands. And this had a lot to do with the collapse of the Soviet Union and Yugoslavia, because these events and the emergence of the new states in the former Soviet and Yugoslav space, it introduced new norms of recognition, right? New norms of international legitimacy. Suddenly, the new states that came out of Yugoslavia and the Soviet Union, in order to become states, in order to gain legitimacy, they didn't need to show that they were former economies. They needed to show that they can actually govern themselves. They needed to show that they can develop institutions. And the Southern Sudanese leadership and the Kurdish leadership, you know, they were not blind to these changes. They started realizing that the practices, right, the practices of liberation are changing. And they were quick to embrace it because of their long experience in fighting for liberation. They were very quick to embrace these new practices, to realize that, you know, there are changes. And if they wish to, you know, if they wish to remain in existence as liberation movements, let alone becoming independent state, they have to also shift their strategies at least slightly to recalibrate some of their strategies and to put more emphasis on governance, right, on institution building. And you can see in both cases, in the case of Kurdistan, of course, you actually had the Kurdistan regional government emerging with, establishing a government and a parliament and very rudimentary institutions, but still, right, showing that they are trying to govern themselves. Now, of course, the Kurdish liberation movement in Iraq has been facing tremendous difficulties. In the mid-1990s, there was the civil war between the KDP and the PUK. After 2003, the main difficulties to the existence of the Kurdistan regional government have come not necessarily from Baghdad, but from external actors, right, especially Turkey and Iran. Whereas in the case of Southern Sudan was actually lucky in the sense that the Sudanese government at some point relinquished its claim over South Sudan and accepted. Again, there are so many reasons for that, but the Sudanese government accepted, you know, Southern Sudan's demand for independence. But even now, I think the legacies of the Liberation War in South Sudan, they are still, you know, they are still in place. They are still affecting the South Sudanese state. And as you probably know, as some of the listeners probably know, South Sudan has suffered from internal violence and civil war for most of its existence. And I think a lot of it had to do with the circumstances of the birth of South Sudan as a state. The foundations, right, the base, my basic argument is still relevant. Practices and roles shape the way actors think, and especially when it comes to separatist and separatist movements and or national liberation movement, because these ideas do not simply vanish. They remain in the minds of the nationalist leaderships, and they still develop them. You know, these ideas still evolve and keep developing.
Yeah, because there is what they call intergenerational learning practices, exactly shaping the way people think and then, of course, act and even design their future projects, I think. So, yeah, Yaniv, this is going to be your last question. And it was a very informative, insightful session, not only for me, I think, but also for our listeners. Considering the focus of these two amazing books on liberation movements from comparative perspective, I'm very curious about your current projects. Can you please tell us a little bit about what you are currently working on and maybe some of your potential future projects as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to do it. I'll do it shortly because I know I've been talking a lot. But one of the things that I picked up in my research on the Iraqi and Sudanese responses to the insurgency was these governments, right? The Iraqi and Sudanese governments' use of local militias as part of their counterinsurgency efforts. And this really, and once again, you can see how one project ends up leading to another. So I really become interested in pro-government militias and how governments use, how governments use militias to fight insurgency, but how militias, right? How these ad hoc forces end up becoming social and political actors. So I'm actually now, I'm now dedicating most of my time to studying pro-government militias in different contexts. And I have to admit that unlike the book that we've been discussing so far, this is much more contemporary. I focus much more on recent years. And of course, I keep sticking to Iraq and Sudan because these are cases that I'm really fascinated by. There's so much to learn from them. But I'm also expanding to other cases to understand how militias, how pro-government militias are in fact becoming social and political actors.
Yes, that sounds fascinating. And I think there's this growing literature on paramilitaries in several different contexts. So I'm pretty sure it's going to be a very interesting project. So we are looking forward to reading your future work. And thank you very much for your time, Yaniv. It was wonderful having you today for our Kurdish Studies podcast series at New Books Network.
Thank you so much, Dilan, for having me. It was really great discussing the book, and I'm really glad to be on New Books Network. So thanks again. Thanks so much.